Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Clyde Haberman began working for newspapers in 1964, first as a copy boy at the New York Times and then as the City College of New York correspondent. After a stint at the New York Post, he returned to the Times in 1977, where he has been the staff editor of the Week in Review section, a Metro reporter, the City Hall bureau chief, and from 1982 to 1995, a foreign correspondent in Tokyo, Rome, and Jerusalem. Major stories he's covered include the Attica Prison Rebellion in 1971, the fall of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines in 1986, South Korea's pro-democracy uprising in 1987, the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe in 1989, the 1990 Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and the 1991 Persian Gulf War, the 1993 Oslo Accords between Israel and the Palestinians, the rise of Islamic terrorism in the Middle East, and the aftermath of the September 11th attacks in 2001. He joins me now to discuss his career and the changes in journalism that he has witnessed over the past 6 decades. I'm so pleased you could join us.
Oh, I'm delighted and very flattered that I'd be your first guest, and I hope this goes well. I'm among those who are still very mystified by what happened at WNYC. I won't push you on going into that, but it's left a bad taste for many New Yorkers, and so this is wonderful.
But looking at that list of things that you've done, it's obvious you've really been around. And have I left anything out?
No. Well, I had my New York column for about 17, 18 years. And
I forgot the TV show.
Yeah, that's okay. And I was, and still am to some degree, it's now on CUNY TV rather than New York One, a regular gas bag on the New York Times show on both those stations. And I've done a few other things. I just finished until a couple of months ago a 9-month stint on the Times editorial board, helping out during a stretch when they were shorthanded, and that was an interesting change of pace. And if I can plug myself one more time, I've been working with a group of terrific videographers in an outfit called Retro Report, which contracts with the Times. These are major news stories of the past that they go back and explore to show how they continue to resonate today. It's not just a waltz down memory lane, which can be tedious, in fact, the past informs the present, as we all know, and this shows it graphically. And I write a long, long commentary with some reporting of my own to accompany it.
I just realized I forgot to mention that in 2009, you were part of a Times team that won the Pulitzer Prize for breaking news, the coverage of the prostitution scandal that led to Elliot Spitzer's resignation as New York governor. That scandal feels almost tame these days.
It does, doesn't it? But I think one reason the scandal became a scandal, aside from the fact that it's we don't particularly like our governors to consort with prostitutes. But it was the
so many do.
But the hypocrisy was, if you will, naked. Spitzer had campaigned against prostitution as being an oppression of women, particularly vulnerable women, very often women of color, and so there he was doing what he was doing. And again, hypocrisy in the end wins out more often than I think any of us are happy with.
You edited a book called The Times of the 70s, the culture, politics, and personalities that shaped the decade. How many things remain the same for a journalist?
Well, the basics, I think, are always going to be there of hoping to present the story fairly, completely. I don't think that changes. But obviously the delivery systems are entirely different. The demands on reporters today are extraordinary. I could see it to some degree through my eldest, Maggie, who's a political reporter at the Times, covers this White House. And, you know, they have to be on Twitter. They have to throw stuff up very fast for the web. When I was, for example, wherever I was, covering a major breaking story, particularly if I was in East Asia, and I was anywhere from 12 to 14 hours ahead of New York, and therefore way ahead of the deadline, I felt practically like the historian Arnold Toynbee compared to what is possible now, where I had all night, if I wanted to write my story, and it still would only be late morning back in New York. So that's not possible now. It's get it up on the web, get it up fast. Sometimes it may come at the expense of 100% accuracy. That's a bit of a occupational hazard. But I think that part is often overstated by those who don't like us. It is amazing to me that reporters today do as much as they do. It's a pace that too old for this pace, but it's an extraordinary pace, and I wish more people appreciated it.
Well, she, your daughter, Maggie, appears on cable news shows all the time.
That too.
If she has a breaking story, they talk to her about it. That's a big change, isn't it? You weren't invited to be on radio or TV every time you broke a story.
No, not at all. And in fact, in my early years, the Times discouraged reporters going on there. The attitude of the editors was, why should we be giving away essentially free that which is our own material?
Now it's seen as good advertising.
Now it's branding, and I understand that. And she has a contract with CNN. Other reporters do too, with CNN and MSNBC, Times reporters. I don't think anybody has one with Fox. Now it's expected that they would do it, and in a way that's fine. It is, you could talk things through very often that perhaps wouldn't have occurred to you, and still go back and then write your story. So,
on the other hand, it seems to me that watching these cable news shows, something happened, the president said something, or some other event occurred, and then they just chew over the same thing again and again. They bring in another panel, and we wind up with very minimal news and an awful lot of the same detail.
Well, if you're going to have a 24-hour network, I don't see how you're going to avoid rehashing a lot of stuff over and over again. I'm not suggesting it's entirely desirable. Part of the problem with cable news, in my view, and I confess I don't watch it that much, so I'm hardly an expert, but from my encounters with it does seem to go over the same material again and again just to fill the time. And that's, I don't know how desirable that is. Maybe there is another way to go at the news. You know, CNN is attacked routinely by this president, and that makes me laugh somewhat contemptuously a lot, because CNN helped contribute to his election. They would follow him everywhere in 2015 and 2016. I have memories of turning on CNN and they'd be showing Trump's plane, you know, standing there on the tarmac waiting to take off. That's not even remotely news. That's not anything. And so surely there's a better way that you have to fill the time.
Getting back to your book about the 70s, we have a sense today that the media have been under a lot of attack. But back in the 70s, didn't Richard Nixon tell his Joint Chiefs of Staff that the press is your enemy? They're trying to stick a knife right into our groin?
Yeah, he did. But I'm not sure Nixon ever said that the media, the press, are the enemy of the American people.
Just the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his administration.
Yeah, that may be, you know, and I'm not even sure that was true. But clearly the role of the press is not always appreciated by major politicians. That goes left and right, by the way.
And it goes back to Thomas Jefferson.
Absolutely.
Did you know that Thomas Jefferson, the man who inspired the Bill of Rights, once wrote this to a newspaper? Nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that political vehicle.
But I believe Jefferson also said that, and you and I were both there, Leonard, obviously, that if he had to choose between a government without a press or a press without a government, he'd choose the latter. So Jefferson was a complicated figure on many levels, as we know. But this is... If we're going to bring it to today, what we're seeing now is qualitatively different. Have all presidents dissembled or even lied on occasion? Of course. Obama was a problem in many ways. He took more reporters to court, his administration did, than all the others that preceded him. So I don't want to be starry-eyed about the predecessors, but never have we had a person who declares journalists to be enemies of the people and who tells untruths, lies, if you will. The word lie gets into the question of intent and gets a little complicated, but certainly he just natters on falsely. Before coming to the studio, I caught a little bit. I couldn't watch the whole thing of his news conference with Putin in Helsinki. And I left on three or four absolute untruths coming out of his mouth. So it makes it more adversarial in that regard. It's not fully healthy, but it is what it is, and we have to deal with it. It is not our job to simply be stenographers. And if he is saying something that is blatantly false, not simply subject to a different interpretation, but flatly untrue, it is our job to say so.
Well, one of the big differences, it seems to me, is that over the years, many countries have talked about fake news, or in 1997, a Russian newspaper was declared an enemy of the state. Fake news, the Myanmar military junta talked about fake news. Cesar Chavez said Global Vision was an enemy of the Venezuelan state. But the surprise seems, to me anyway, is that we're hearing this sort of thing right here in the United States.
Exactly. And none of the countries and the governments that you just mentioned are any that we really should be keeping company with in terms of freedoms and the concept of free expression and freedom of the press.
My guest is Clyde Haberman on Leonard Lopate at Large today on WBAI 99.5 FM. But is the press totally blameless? Haven't there been many examples of the press slanting the news over the history of the country, usually to reflect the biases of the newspaper's owners?
To some degree, sure. Look, if you go back historically in the 18th, 19th century, surely the press was basically newspapers were functionaries of political parties to a large degree. That's unquestionably so. The concept of journalism changed. It probably started somewhere in maybe in the 1920s or 30s, but I'm not a historian on this, so I could be wrong. But certainly in the post-World War II era, essentially my entire life, the concept of objectivity, or at least fairness, I think has taken hold. And I think that is true whether the editorial position of the paper slants left or slants right. The news coverage of the Wall Street Journal, for example, even though that page that paper's editorial page was quite to the right of center, even before Rupert Murdoch bought it a few years ago, I believe its news coverage was largely impeccable. I think that is true of the New York Times too. Have there been foul-ups? Of course. The last time I looked, these are human institutions and therefore by definition flawed. And we can go through the list of sins, whether it's how we covered the supposed weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist in Saddam Hussein's hands, or the Jason Blair debacle for the Times, or the probably the greatest journalistic malfeasance on the Times' part, and many other newspapers too, but the Times looms larger than most, if not all.
Because it's the most respected newspaper in this country.
Was the absolutely inadequate to the point of disgraceful coverage of the Nazi Holocaust, in which the notion that there were even that these were Jews being murdered en masse was downplayed to a large degree. And so, no, there are many things that were done wrongly and for which papers have been and have allowed themselves to be called to account. But on balance, pardon me, I think the Republic is still better off for us than not.
It can get rather subtle. I remember reading many years ago about headlines from two New York newspapers with opposing political points of view and the coverage of an Alf Landon rally in 1936. The Herald Tribune, which was very much a Republican-biased part of newspaper, had a headline that read something like, 5,000 cheer Landon at the Garden. And the Daily News, which was a strong supporter of FDR, wrote something like, Landon speaks before half-filled garden. Both true.
Both true. No, I mean, that is certainly true. The Landon-Roosevelt race in 36 is a bit before my time, but...
But I'm just trying to say that this is something that newspapers have been doing for a long
absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned my coverage of the Attica prison uprising, which younger listeners may not remember. It was the most devastating prison riot and occupation in our history. It led to, in the end, 43 deaths, 39 of them, on September 13th, 1971, when then Governor Nelson Rockefeller sent state troopers in what a chronicler of this later called a turkey shoot. They just began firing left and right. And there were 10 of the hostages of the prison employees, most of them guards, who had been taken hostage during this four-day siege by these rebellious inmates, were killed. The state immediately put out a story saying that most of them died at the prisoners' hands. Some of them, they had knives, they had their throats slashed by knives. One of them, the story said, was even castrated. A very courageous, and we all reported it that way, as absolute fact. The Times did. I was at the New York Post then. I did. The Daily News.
The Post was a liberal newspaper
in those days. Yeah, but all the major newspapers in New York stated as fact that these captive prison employees had been killed by the rebellious prisoners. A courageous coroner, medical examiner in Rochester, a guy named Edlund, I forget his first name, must have worked all night doing autopsies on all these bodies, came out the next day to say not a single inmate had his throat, had died from throat slashing. One had a throat slash, but it was not fatal. They were all killed, and certainly nobody was castrated. They were all killed at the hands of the raiding state troopers and their guns. And that, for me, was a lifelong lesson. I was 26 years old at the time. Never forgot that. My feeling was, oh my goodness, if they're going to lie to you about something like this, something that could easily be disproved within a matter of hours, then what won't they lie about? You know, I don't believe, I'm not trying to suggest that officialdom is always lying and never to be believed, but I put these kinds of things in other people's mouths. He said, she said, they said, and not necessarily state as fact. It was a very valuable lesson for a young reporter, but it's a kind of error that we will make, I'm afraid, again and again, not just because at the New York Times, but in journalism.
One of the big differences today is when something like that happens and there's a police report that a guy came up to the cops with a gun, and then it turns out that we get a video of him moving in the opposite direction and being shot in the back. It creates a big sensation immediately. I don't know if that has changed the public's perception of just how much you can believe.
Well, it may have. You know, if you're touching on police shootings of usually young black men, we've seen enough video to not necessarily. Again, I don't automatically disbelieve those in authority, but I don't automatically accept their version either. And what amazes me is that people in position of authority continue to lie about things, and that includes the police, when they know there are cameras rolling. I find that extraordinary and inexplicable, quite frankly. Does it increase, to your question, does it increase skepticism in general? Probably. But I think that skepticism was already fairly well entrenched. You know, a lot of Americans, my sense of it, Leonard, going back to the 70s, was until something like Attica, until then, very soon followed by the Watergate scandal, followed by revelations about the conduct and duplicities that went into the war in Vietnam, one after another after another, I think a lot of people in this country come hardwired as skeptics from the get-go, so that modern technology may enhance that skepticism, but I think it's already pretty well established.
I want to get back to something that you mentioned earlier. Many have argued that the ideal of completely objective coverage of any of most news stories is something that's impossible to live up to, and then others complain when, in an effort to look even-handed, the press coverage presents opposing views as being equal. CNN will often pit a liberal against a conservative on a panel and let them talk all over each other, reminding us about that old Saturday Night Live skit with Jane Curtin and Dan Aykroyd.
Right. Jane, you ignorant slut. I think it was his favorite line on that. Objectivity. Is there such a thing? Look, reporters come with their own attitudes. The issue, it seems to me, can you set them aside reasonably well enough? Look, there are three of us sitting in this room right now, you, me, and our colleague here.
Our audio engineer, Richie Johnson.
Richie Johnson, I'm sorry. I'm terrible. Forgive me, Richie. I'm an idiot with names. They fall right out of my head.
It's and, all good.
I'm willing to bet that if at the end of the show we were each asked, what did you talk about, we would come up with three different points of emphasis on it. It's just, that's called human nature. It goes way back. The last time I looked at the New Testament, there were four Gospels of all describing the same basic situation. So who do you listen to, Mark or Luke, Matthew? It's not a matter of political biases, let's say, or gender biases necessarily clouding reportage. To some degree, it will. But I think most reporters I know are pretty honest folk. I think they do try, and that includes, by the way, I don't mean at the New York Times. I'm talking about publications that whose point of view is quite different from mine. Let's say even the New York Post or the Wall Street Journal.
Your son Zach Haberman works for the Daily News.
My son Zach is a senior editor at the Daily News. I have a third child, Emma, who did not go into journalism, and she's known in the family as the smart one. I'm amazed that my kids went into the business, but there you have it. I do think most reporters and editors really are trying to present a fair account of whatever the story is that they're covering. Are there slip-ups? You bet. Again, we listed some of them already. And now on occasion, you get a horror show. You get a guy like Jack Kelly at USA Today who was just simply making stuff up and was let go. You get a Stephen Glass at the New Republic. You get a Jason Blair who just ruined life for all of us at the Times for a long time. I knew we were in trouble. I was not... I'm not a watcher of much of the late night shows, but I began to watch Jay Leno in that period just for his monologue, because he would always have a Jason Blair joke in it. And I was just curious to see if I were home at that hour, just what or I taped it actually, what he was saying. And I knew we were in deep trouble when he stopped having to say, Jason Blair, hey, you hear the latest about Jason Blair, the New York Times report or whatever, and he would simply say, you hear about Jason Blair. And I knew, oh my God, if Blair's name has already now entered Middle America dialogue, we are in serious trouble. The Washington Post had Janet Cook, who invented a 7 or 8 year old heroin addict back in the 80s. We get plagued by this. I don't understand those reporters. And I really don't understand it in the age of the internet and Google and various modes of detecting plagiarism. You ain't going to get away with it. You never were, really, but now you absolutely can't. So it's an endless mystery to me. But what needs to be remembered is that those numbers, their numbers are few, very few.
On the other hand, if a story, no matter how accurate, touches a nerve to in an influential group, isn't the reporter accused of bias?
Oh, of course. Look, I had this thing last week. I've been reasonably active on Twitter in the last few years. Probably a columnist, you know, once a gas bag, always a gas bag, and needing a forum. And somebody, a young person with a magazine, complained about the Times giving Alan Dershowitz any ink at all. He's been shunned by a lot of people on Martha's Vineyard where he vacations. She complained about that. Why would the Times put this on page one? It turned out there were a couple of more stories that I frankly had missed, and were one or two too many, as even our editor in chief, the executive editor Dean Baquet, said. But she said, rather, you know, snarkily, can't wait to see what they're going to do about, you know, the crisis taking place at the southern border. Now, maybe she was being ironic and I missed it, although I doubt it. But we'd had dozens and dozens of stories about what's happening down at the border, the separation of kids from their parents. And I made a comment, a very negative comment about it. I had hundreds of people, mostly on the left, frankly, all on the left, in fact, who were screaming, you know, about me, about my daughter. Somehow she got plugged into this, about how we've enabled this presidency, how Alan Dershowitz should not even have a single story in the paper, and on it went. And I'm sorry, I know I'm on BAI, but folks, the loony left is no more thrilling than the loony right. It just has less power.
I was just, yes, in fact, I was going to get to the whole business about why Rush Limbaugh had so much success, whereas Air America was a failure.
Yeah. I think Air America, Limbaugh speaks to the worst of human nature, and so do folks like, I'm blanking, I get names go through my head, as Richie has just learned.
Sean Hannity.
Not just Hannity, but the guy, I'm taking too much airtime with trying to remember the name, but the guy who just said, you know, on July 4th, the Democrats are going to have a revolution. Mm-hmm. Alex Jones. Sorry. Takes me a while. And exactly. And so
what happens after the revolution doesn't occur?
I don't know. Well, I guess we go back
to
watching.
Just ignore it?
I don't know. I watch Law and Order reruns. But it's, you know, Alex Jones. So these people appeal to the worst of human nature. I don't think Air America did that. And we have a president now who appeals to the worst of a lot of people's natures rather than seeking to unify a country. I think the right-wing demagogues have been much more effective than those on the left because they're much more ready to go that route. And certainly the big mouths among them, the Limbaughs, the Hannitys, the Alex Joneses, and the left has never, you know, whatever flaws I may find in it, and I obviously do because I've just now referred to the loony left. I do believe there are a fair number there. But again, they lack the power, and now there's not even a shred of political power because the right has the White House, it has both houses of Congress, it has a lock on the Supreme Court. What more do you need?
On the other hand, MSNBC's ratings have gone up considerably.
Yeah. And the Times' circulation, I don't know about print circulation necessarily, but overall subscriptions, including digital, have gone up too. And it's helped. But that's not the same as power. And the right just... The whining about, the liberal press and all that runs counter to the reality that virtually all radio of real influence and power on a broad basis are in the hands of right wingers, and the most important cable network, Fox News, I have described it in my own tweets as state television. I think it amounts to that now. MSNBC was never that to Obama. CNN is certainly not that to any of them, whatever its flaws may be. And the New York Times is certainly not. I mean, ask either Bill or Hillary Clinton what it thinks of the New York Times and its coverage, not just of the 2016 campaign. Bill Clinton hated the Times editorial page editor at the Times, Hal Raines, who was a fellow Southerner. And just felt it was unfair.
On the other hand, yeah, many Bernie Sanders supporters felt that the Times really was pushing for Hillary to win the nomination.
I don't know if that's actually the case. Bernie Sanders, in my view, I know there are a lot of folks who are listening who absolutely disagree with me, and so it goes. Didn't often say new things, Isha, not that Hillary Clinton necessarily did either. Basically, whatever you asked Bernie Sanders, he said, I oppose the war in Iraq, and I oppose this, and two or three points. I don't think there is a tendency on the part of people, both left and right, to assume that if their cause lost, if their candidate lost, it's the press's fault. If only it had been covered differently, all would have been good. And I don't buy that.
I'm Leonard Lopate talking to Clyde Haberman on Leonard Lopate at Large.
Bad news, bad times, trouble all over the land. Bad news. Bad times, trouble all over the land. The nation is fighting internal war, killing its young, starving out its poor.
Clyde Haberman is my guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large here on WBAI 99.5 FM. What about radio? Now, many people, you said that the right, the conservatives, commentators have really dominated radio, but NPR News and BBC News are among the most listened to around the country because people do trust them.
Right. No, they're very important and very influential. And somebody's just handing me water. Thank you very much. But in terms of ginning up anger, it's not even a contest to compare NPR versus Alex Jones, to go back to him, Michael Savage, Limbaugh. They're working different universes. Now, you mentioned the BBC and NPR. Someone on the right might say, they're totally biased and all. That's a question of emphasis, perhaps, on news coverage. But the intent is not, and as I see it, is not to gin up the masses, you know, to go out there with pitchforks and torches.
How important a role has the internet played?
Oh, hugely, of course.
A fair amount of the news these days is in response to tweets and posts on Facebook.
Yes.
Do reporters nowadays have to follow the newsmakers on social media?
Yes, they do. The question, though, is, and I suspect, look, I'm not in the Times newsroom much these days, I suspect they ask this question virtually every day. How much do you allow the president's tweets, you know, at 6 a.m. to guide your day? Arguably, we are led too much by it, not just the Times, but everybody in general. The president this morning said blah, blah. And it's usually the same thing, you know, no collusion, rigged elections, rigged system. Failing New York Times, crooked Hillary, blah, 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 blah. And
Obama is to blame.
And, of course, everything is Obama's fault. Look, one of the things that this guy has done, I am convinced, is that he is doing everything he possibly can to erase any trace of America's first African-American president. It's not just changing policies on this or that. He's entitled not to agree with Obama on a lot of things. I don't agree with Obama on a lot of things, but I think he's trying to erase even the existence of this guy through changing every regulation, environmental and others that have come that came during those 8 years, and of course policies overall affecting Russia, affecting the Middle East, and it is disappointing. But we ought not be led by the tweets necessarily. It's hard to resist. I recognize that. I've been a journalist for more than half a century, and it's easy to follow the bouncing ball and get misled by it. But
it seems to me the real change is that everything is so much faster today. When you began working as a journalist in the 60s, there were no cable news channels. There were the newspapers. There was Time, Newsweek,
and television.
And television, but television news and radio news is pretty much snapshots. And the newspapers and the news magazines were there for the more complete story.
Yes.
And now it all seems to have changed.
You had more, well, you had, you know, everybody goes back to Walter Cronkite on CBS as the most trusted person in America, and to some degree that was true. I don't think it's legend and fiction at that, American attitudes toward the war in Vietnam changed when Walter Cronkite basically said, this isn't working. I think that happened. I don't think you have, even with the voices I just said, you know, stirring up passions on the right, you don't have that kind of national figure anymore. I actually think, Leonard, on a very broad scale, that our democracy is threatened by the fact that we increasingly don't have shared information. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan very famously said that you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. I think that people now believe they are entitled to their own facts, and in fact, they can make sure that they absorb facts that only validate their worldview, whether it's by watching only MSNBC or watching only Fox, or by going to websites or certain radio stations that absolutely reinforce their preconceived notions. And that, to me, is the greatest danger to democracy, is if we do not agree even upon a shared set of facts, though we may then interpret them differently, we're in trouble.
You started working in newspapers in the early 60s. Were all of those newspapers still around? We had the Times, the Herald Tribune, the Daily News, the Daily Mirror every morning, the Post, the World Telegram and Sun, Journal American in the afternoon, plus the Brooklyn Eagle, Long Island Press, Newsday. Did that guarantee a healthier journalistic environment?
Yes.
The more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. And even, you know, you mentioned the world. They were beginning to die as I was entering the field.
Union disputes.
Union disputes to some degree and lack of advertising. The Daily Mirror, the New York Mirror, died in 1963, I think, after the big newspaper strike of 1962 and 63, 114 days, I think it was. If I remember right, it had something like 800,000 circulation, but it didn't have advertising because it overlapped to some degree with the readership of the New York Daily News. And God help us. I mean, the Daily News had a circulation of 2.1 or 2.2 million. And soon thereafter, the World Telegram and Sun died, then the Journal American died, and it's worth remembering that the World Telegram and the Sun were once three separate newspapers. The World, the Telegram, and the Sun. Ditto the Journal and the American. Ditto the Herald and the Tribune. So now we're down to three big ones. And the Times, as far as I could tell, is the only one that really makes money. The others subsist on the beneficence of wealthy benefactors. Mort Zuckerman got tired of being that, so he sold the Daily News to this horribly named company, Tronc, which is the Tribune Online company. I'm not sure why anybody wants to name itself something that sounds like a sneeze. But Rupert Murdoch, for say what he will, keeps the Post alive. It'll be interesting to see if this paper, which was founded by Alexander Hamilton in 1801, will survive. Murdoch, I'm not 100% sure if his sons, and they're the ones who basically will take over the empire, are as interested in print as Rupert Murdoch, for better or worse, has been.
I was wondering about all those newspapers. Who chose which one to read? Didn't people just tend to read the papers that reflected their own political views? Is that all that different than people turning on Fox or MSNBC or CNN today?
I think it is, because I think that even though you're right, you're absolutely right, that people reinforced their views with the newspapers they bought. The paper of choice in the house I grew up in was the New York Post, which was a liberal paper in those days, although my parents weren't particularly liberal politically. The Daily News was sort of seen as, look, I grew up in this Orthodox Jewish family. The Daily News was seen as the newspaper of the Irish and the Italians. Yeah. New York is very ethnically tribal, shall we say. It's not necessarily hatred. It's just people go to their own corners. But I still think those newspapers provided more of opposing views, or at least information, again, as opposed to the sheer doctrinaire quality of a lot of talk radio and a lot of, let's say, Fox or whatever. This, again, it goes back to my shared facts. I think we had more shared facts, even if the presentations were different.
Although, after those newspapers went under, we wound up with all news radio stations like WABC, FM, and WINS. But they didn't have any opinions because they just simply gave you the equivalent of a headline.
Right. And they had all that airtime to fill. And some politicians are very smart. Locally, for example, Ed Koch, I covered Ed Koch's City Hall in the last several years of his first term before I went overseas. They would waylay the mayor in the hallway on his way to the bathroom. I'm not exaggerating, because they just had to get his comment on everything. And it reached absurd levels. They would ask Mayor Koch, you know, what he thought about the selling of marketing of infant formula in third world countries and thereby harming children's health because they weren't being breastfed as much. Believe me, Ed Koch didn't know anything about this, but they didn't stop him from talking. So there was this need to fill all this airtime.
I'm speaking with veteran journalist Clyde Haberman on Leonard Lopate at Large today here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. In speaking to other journalists, do you get the feeling, do they feel that they're more under attack these days. For example, there was a report in the New York Observer that former Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos sent threatening messages to a number of reporters. He wrote, "I can't wait for the vigilante squads to start gunning journalists down on site."
Yeah, no, this young man really deserves to be shunned. You know, there's no reason to, for anybody to quote him on anything. Who is he? So that bothers me. But yes, reporters have been doxed, a term of art these days, a document found with threatening letters sent to their homes. You know, it's one of those "we know where you live" situation. It's very worrisome. They are more visible because a lot of them are on television, as was I for a stretch. And so it works both ways of people. You become more, on one level, it's helpful because you become more a real person when people have seen you on television and so on. On the other hand, you are more vulnerable nut jobs.
When you were reporting from the Middle East, it seems to me that no matter what you said, somebody was going to be angry by
Absolutely.
It.
Especially, you know, when I was based in Israel, I couldn't make anybody happy. That's for sure. I'll tell you, in the last, especially since the start of the Iraq War back in 2003, and maybe even a couple of years earlier when we went into Afghanistan after 9/11, it is much more dangerous to be a foreign correspondent overseas. We've had plenty of deaths. We've had shootings. This is going to sound racist. I don't mean it such, but the reality was when I was in Asia, and a few times I happened to cover Africa or I was in the Middle East, I always felt that, frankly, being a white male worked to my advantage. I was never going to be in danger, even in situations that were shooting situations. That's not true anymore. The press badge, and certainly the racial part, to whatever degree I'm right on that, that's out. It's a dangerous world out there, much more than when I was a foreign correspondent from 1982 to 95.
According to the International Federation of Journalists, at least 81 reporters were killed doing their jobs in 2017, and that number is slightly down from 2016 when the number was 93 killed. Also, harassment and attacks on journalists have been on the rise, and the IFJ cautioned that an unprecedented number of journalists were jailed in 2017. More than 250 are still in prison.
No, it's very dangerous.
Which is leading to self-censorship, do you think?
Well, it might. I mean, and understandably, one has a responsibility to one's own life and one's family. But it goes. I go back to President Trump's, you know, enemy of the people line and fake news, fake news, fake news all the time. That mantra has been picked up by one despot after another, whether it's Duterte in the Philippines or Erdogan in Turkey, and we are seeing it with other basically fascist leaders now in Poland and Hungary. They're all echoing the same themes, and when you have the President of the United States, of all people, declaring news gatherers to be the enemy of the people, it not only emboldens, but it absolutely validates those who will put people in prison and have the power to do that, let alone execute them, as we've seen Trump's good buddy Vladimir Putin do.
On the other hand, some of the president's supporters in Congress have been disturbed. Marco Rubio tweeted recently, "Lack of trust in reporting leaves us vulnerable to conspiracy theories and unable to have debates because we can't even agree on baseline facts."
Right. Well, I certainly agree with that statement, except I'm not so sure how much faith I'd put in Marco Rubio on any of this. I mean, Marco Rubio is will talk a good game and then go the other way. He really is kind of craven.
Brad Pascali, President Trump's 2020 campaign manager, called for the suspension of CNN's Jim Acosta's press credentials after Acosta shouted questions at Trump and Kim Jong-un during their summit meeting in Singapore. And in response, Jim Acosta tweeted, "Dear Brad, dictatorships take away press credentials, not democracies."
Absolutely. No, I mean, these are fundamental rights. That doesn't mean that every reporter is brilliant or every news organization gets it right all the time. But no, they're speaking the language of despots. And again, previous presidents have sought to rein in people. One of the more famous examples was John Kennedy called in the publisher then of the Times, New York Times, Arthur Oak Sulzberger, Punch Sulzberger as he was nicknamed, to complain and hoping that that Sulzberger would order the removal of David Halberstam from Vietnam, which coming because President Kennedy did not like David's coverage there, which was very skeptical of what the U.S. was doing. This was in the early 1960s, of course. Well, Sulzberger went back to New York and ordered that Halberstam, who was about to go on vacation, not go on vacation because he didn't want it to appear as if he was yielding to the president. That's the way we respond. This is a democracy, and you want to take away credentials? Fine, we'll cover you another way. But you're not in charge. The people are in charge.
Why do you think Jim Acosta has rankled Donald Trump so much to the point where his followers at a rally in South Carolina shouted, "Go home," and CNN sucks, and then the president refused to answer a question from Mr. Acosta at a press conference in Britain just the other day because he said CNN does fake news. Right. Instead, he took a question from John Roberts, who works for Fox.
What I wish, Robert, look, I don't know Acosta, and I don't really watch, as I said before, I don't really watch cable news that much, so I don't know to what degree is he an irritating fellow, or is he just doing his job? You know, you couldn't get more irritating. Older listeners may remember Sam Donaldson on ABC. He was absolutely beyond nothing. Nobody suggested that Sam Donaldson was fake or whatever. Just annoying. What I wish John Roberts had done, I said this on Twitter, and got hundreds of people agreeing with me for what that's worth. I wish at that point he tossed the question right back to Acosta. Part of the problem is the press corps. Everybody has his own or her own question, and each network wants its own time on it. And instead, what they should do is apply Article 5 of NATO to themselves. An attack on one is an attack on all. And I wish Roberts did defend CNN and Acosta. But what I wish he'd done was say, "Well, actually, Mr. President, I think Acosta had a question for you." And then if Trump moved on to a different reporter, that reporter should have said, "Oh, well, let's go back to Acosta." It has nothing to do with Acosta. It has to do with the president declaring an entire major network to be fake and declaring us all to be enemies of the people.
Aren't you teaching an honors seminar course at Macaulay Honors College?
I am, at Hunter, in New York City.
Are your students concerned about the hostility toward reporters these days?
I haven't gone into that too much. Usually we talk about the city itself, so I haven't asked too much. But some have expressed concern to me. I don't know if they're a majority or not. I can't tell. They're smart young people, and I'm reminded of my age at times. I hope to do it again. I only do this in the spring. And so in the spring of 2019, they're all 19 years old. That means they were 1 or 2 years old when September 11th happened. If that doesn't make you feel old, nothing does.
And in fact, in talking about many of the things that you've covered, I would assume that a great, maybe even a majority of our listeners weren't alive for
probably
for
not. You're mentioning of the 1970s several times earlier. The 1970s is a essential frame of reference for me in this course on, it's called Shaping the Future of the City, because as older people will remember, we were on the verge of bankruptcy then, and the city really looked like it had had it. And whether it was in terms of crime or finances, and just the spirit of the city had been totally broken. It looked like we were finished, and we weren't.
Well, that does it for today's show. My great thanks to Clyde Haberman
Thank
for being
so
such
much.
A wonderful guest.
Thank-
Well, that does it for this week's show. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.